south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander...
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. Here's some interesting facts, always relating to living, working, playing, and or retiring here in Latin America. Now, you probably know, because baseball is the national sport in the States, at least I think it is still. Could be football, I don't know. Anyway, historically, baseball has always been considered the national sport, right? Well, I'm sure you realize a great percentage of Major League Baseball players are Latinos. Nothing wrong with that. When you're good, you're good. But here in Latin America, it's odd to see people playing baseball. Soccer's the national sport, or football. They call it football. Football. And your kind of football, they call football americano, American football. Like your style of football is just an afterthought. Now, the irony there, of course, is that since most Latinos don't speak English, they don't realize the very name football has foot in it and ball in it. Two particularly descriptive English words that they use for their own national sport, but have no idea that the words actually have meaning beyond the playing of a sport. It's just like the use, or I should say overuse, of the word VIP. Very important person. Well, Latinos use that for VIP lounge and VIP parking, VIP crapper, etc. Having no idea that VIP is not a real word, but an acronym. Now, if you want that deer in the headlights look, just try to explain that to a non-English-speaking Latino. But I digress. Where were we? Oh, yeah, sports. Of course, in every professional sport, including hockey, billiards, and cockfighting. Wait a minute. Yep, that's right. Cockfighting is a professional sport here in Latin America. And it's got nothing to do with porno. And man, do I have a cool cockfighting boots on the ground story to tell you. I'll get to that maybe in next week's show. Anyway, when it comes to professional sports, practically all genders, races, and creeds are represented, right? Though I don't think there are any Muslims at all playing American football, even in schools and sandlots. Why? Come on, you really think they're going to win one for the Gipper when the ball's a pigskin? All right, no more digressing here. Now, as far as those 20 Latin American countries, there are only four that have picked up on baseball so much that it's actually their national sport. Can you guess which countries? Now, I'm sure you picked Cuba. That's one of them. The other three, Dominican Republic, Venezuela, and Puerto Rico. Yep, Puerto Rico is considered a country even though it really is a U.S. territory or protectorate. So anyway, you check out the roster of any professional baseball team. There's going to be some Cubans, Venezuelans, Dominicans, and Puerto Ricans. Nope, no Argentines, Brazilians, Ecuadorians, Guatemalans. You're just not going to see them. Now, the amazing thing is, considering all four of these baseball-loving Latino countries, Venezuela is the absolute top of the top. They love baseball so much, you can't get in your car and drive 10 minutes without seeing kids playing a game in an empty lot somewhere. In fact, Venezuela's so nuts about baseball, it's a major supplier of talent to the U.S. major leagues. And they don't demand gringo prices either, at least not at first. Get this, an astounding 74 of Major League Baseball's current roster of players are from Venezuela. In fact, Venezuela is the number two supplier of foreign talent to the major leagues. So then who's number one? Take a guess. It's not Cuba, it's the DR, Dominican Republic. Believe it or not, they have 84 professional American baseball players on the current roster. So as it turns out, about 10% of all Major League Baseball players are Venezuelans. And of course, these guys are superheroes to their families and their communities and their country. They sent tons of dough back home. In fact, it's been estimated, though I don't know how they come up with this number, they say that every one of those 74 Venezuelan Major League Baseball players is supporting around 40 to 50 family members back home. Same thing with professional baseball players from the DR, Cuba, and Puerto Rico. Now, you might have known or figured that's probably what happens, but here's what you didn't know. In Venezuela, it's become kind of a cottage industry to kidnap family members of famous U.S. Major League Baseball players because they're considered a guaranteed payday and they don't want publicity. In fact, when these guys go back to visit Venezuela, they're targets too. For example, A while back, Washington Nationals catcher Wilson Ramos was kidnapped. And after an air rescue operation with helicopters in the works, it was a million-dollar payday for the people involved. And now, because of all that, Venezuelan major league players are hiring private security agencies to look after their families back home. But there's even a bigger irony. When journalists try to interview these baseball players up in the States, they either have no comment about the situation back home, or they're so PC, you can tell their answers have been scripted, saying things like, well, you know, I can't be political, I can't be on one side or the other, I'm just a baseball player, I just hope for the best for my people. Yeah, right, what a newsflash. Talk about ironies. Since when do celebrities, especially sports figures, keep their mouths shut? You know, it's well known that U.S. sports figures, at least ones born and raised in the States, they never have a problem making fools of themselves at press conferences. Look at Muhammad Ali, Dennis Rodman, Mike Tyson, Pete Rose, Lance Armstrong, Conor McGregor. The list of sports figure blabbermouths is endless. It's even worse when it comes to Hollywood superstar shit for brains. Though with most of them, you'll find if you did a brain scan, they've got a little poop mixed with two neurons firing between a spirochete. Oh, and about famous Hollywood actors. I remember what one of my uncles, a very brilliant guy, once told me. He said the best actors in the world, the ones that get all the awards, are the best liars. They have to be. They succeed when they convince you they're someone that they're not. They're all liars, but the most convincing one gets the Emmy or the Oscar. But I digress. Back to baseball. All right, here's a quote from St. Louis Cardinals player Jose Martinez, also from Venezuela. Quote, it's hard to find bodyguards you can trust, people who will take care of your family like you want them to. It's hard to find the right people for that kind of work. The bodyguards I have, he says, have been with me for 8 years now. I have a good relationship with them, and those are the ones I have in the U.S. Back home in Venezuela, Martinez says he spends $400 a month to employ 7 security guards to watch over his mother, Evelyn, 2 children, Matthias, Alberto, and Elena, 1 5 years old and 1 10 months, respectively. He's got bodyguards for his brother, his stepsister, his grandparents, uncles, aunts, and the whole extended family. All right, do you get that? He spends $400 a month for 7 bodyguards. So each of them gets about $60 a month. Sounds ridiculous, like it's from another world, right? But remember, that's 3 times the minimum wage. Average minimum wage in Venezuela these days, $20 a month. Then he says, I also have bodyguards to watch the bar I purchased a year ago near my hometown of La Guardia. When I go home in the winter, he says, I keep a bodyguard with me at all times, including one stationed at my bedroom door overnight, because I want to know as soon as I wake up, one of my own guys is at the door. Then he says he signed a 2-year, $3.25 million extension on his contract with St. Louis, without a single delay back in February, with almost no negotiation. He signed in record time, in no small part, as a means to protect his family and make sure the dough was coming in. He says he transfers money online weekly to his family back home. He and another Venezuelan major leaguer, Milwaukee first baseman Jesus Aguilar, they get together with some other Venezuelan players and send dozens of boxes of supplies home to Venezuela every week. They got a regular export business going, sending canned tuna, dried meats, medicine, even Advil and Tylenol, which are almost impossible to get in Venezuela now. He says, along with the money, we send boxes of clothes, too. Then he says Arizona outfielder David Pareta tells his sister to shop for anything she can possibly get online. He tells her, get whatever you need, and he'll pay for it. The orders from Amazon and other companies are delivered to one of the handful of companies in Miami, which then deliver them to Venezuela within a week or so. All right, how about this? Did you know the Milwaukee Brewers have the largest Venezuelan contingent in the majors? They've got 6 active Venezuelans on the roster. Oh, and get this. Ramos says that the Venezuelan government has advised them when they come home on their winter break, they should never leave their houses alone, and especially they should never wear anything that targets them as professional baseball players. That means no bling, no designer clothes, no Range Rovers, Escalades, Ferraris, or Lambos. And get this, it says most players will not tell you how much they spend on bodyguards or how much they have to spend to pay off cops and political figures when they're back in Venezuela. Meanwhile, major league players from Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Dominican Republic have no such problems. They make a big point of showing off their success and excess. For them, it's all about bling, cars, clothes, and VIP rooms. VIP rooms, that is. Oh, and the big case you may have heard of where Red Sox former star David Ortiz was shot in the back in a bar in the Dominican Republic. Turns out now, after investigation, they believe he was shot by two cops hired by a Dominican Republic drug lord who knew that this baseball guy was having an affair with his wife. And you know what? Everyone in the DR believes that story. In fact, I happen to know a young lady who's the three-time Dominican Republic bikini fitness champion. You know, those women's hard body competitions. She knows the guy. He's been to some of those fitness events. And she says he's a nice guy, but a walking dick. The Spanish term for that is mujeriego. Mujeriego. That's the guy who hits on anything and everything. Of course, he's a happily married man with kids and all that. This is Latin America, you know, the land of contradictions. By the way, that fitness lady says for him, it was just a matter of time. Because you see, here in Latin America, jealousy on steroids is a way of life. Meanwhile, in the how's that plan B coming department. Yeah, right, as if we need another reason to get the hell out of Dodge. Anyway, here goes. Now, I know lots of Americans who've only been to poop hole towns like Tijuana and Mexican border towns. And they say Latin America is dirty, dingy, scruffy around the edges, and they'd never want to live there. That's the line you hear from so many people who've only been to Mexican poop hole towns. Or they've been to gringo tourist areas, and they say, hey, was nice at the airport, and then I had to take a taxi to the luxury all-inclusive condo complex, and man, the crap neighborhoods we had to go through? Wow, I wish you would have drove in the dark. I didn't want to see that. Well, to shed a little light on that dark subject comes this article, entitled, Skid Row and Skid Marks Are Everywhere, and we just received confirmation that the worst is yet to come. Kind of long and confusing title, but we'll go with it. It's from Michael Snyder. Came out June 7th. Let me paraphrase a bit here. It says, you guys that live in the small towns or out in the boonies probably don't know it, but all over America, large portions of our major cities are being transformed into stomach-churning cesspools of squalor. You don't see many reports on it, but thousands of tent cities are popping up from coast to coast as homeless populations explode. Even in the New York Times, they're admitting now that we're facing the worst drug and homelessness crisis in American history. They openly admit to more than 28,000 official written complaints about human feces on the streets of San Francisco just in last year alone. And rats, well, people are seeing them everywhere. People say they're overrunning the city of Los Angeles, and if you haven't seen one this week, you probably don't get out much. Yet, the government authorities and bureaucrats continue to insist the economy is in good shape and everything is humming along just fine. And it will look like that to you if you live in a heavily sanitized, upscale, wealthy suburban neighborhood and you only get your news from heavily sanitized corporate media sources, and we know who they are, right? However, if you live the city life in the real world, things are getting really bad. As author L.D. Granderson states in the L.A. Times, he describes what life is like right at this moment in L.A. He says, Los Angeles spent $620 million in taxes last year to address the homeless issue, yet the number of homeless people just this year has increased 16%. We've got nearly 60,000 homeless on the streets in L.A., which in aggregate itself is the definition of a small town, 60,000. Then he says, as a Los Angeles resident, I'm among those who are wondering what the hell the mayor's office is doing. When I lived downtown, it was virtually impossible to walk a full block in any direction without seeing a homeless person. In Silver Lake, where I live now, there are tent cities everywhere. I see people living underneath all the highway overpasses. Skid Row has taken on a new meaning. The Skid Row is everywhere. But that phrase, Skid Row is everywhere, or the skid is everywhere, also applies to San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, Denver, Minneapolis, Chicago, Detroit, St. Louis, Memphis, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and virtually every U.S. city. Hey, he forgot Cleveland. Now let's give credit where credit is due. Anyway, he goes on to say, but without a doubt, Los Angeles, where people spend a lot of time outside because of the weather, it's particularly disgusting. In fact, just last week, a columnist for the L.A. Times admitted that Los Angeles, quote, has become a giant trash receptacle, a ripe, unemptied dumpster. If you live there or in any big city, you know it's true. All right, meanwhile, south of the border, there are some scruffy, dingy-looking middle and lower middle-class neighborhoods, that's for sure, along with some very, very nicely manicured upper-class subdivisions in every major city and in the outskirts, too. But there's one thing you just won't find. Tent cities and masses of homeless people. Oh, that's not to say there aren't a few homeless people here and there. Sure, you see them. If you're driving through a big or medium-sized city, you might see a guy sleeping in a doorway, or a Rasta man spread out under a tree with all of his earthly goods in a little plastic sack, but you just don't see conglomerations of them. And you know, this might surprise you, but even the acrobats, human flamethrowers, and machete jugglers, and little guys with squeegees who'll wash your windows for a quarter, they got some place to go at night. Sure, they're street people of sorts during the day, but they're not homeless people. They got some place. A house or a tin shack to go to at night. For sure it's a dump, but they're not living in a cardboard box under a bridge or in a tent city. But you know, it's the damnedest thing. The closer you get to a gringo tourist spot, the more beggars and street urchins. Hey, that's where I'd hang out if my day job was begging for dough. How about you? Oh, and since we're on the time to get the hell out of Dodge subject, here comes another sick but true article. Entitled, How the Feds Audit Owners of Money Counting Machines. Here's the gist of it. The DEA seized over $50 million by secretly spying on Americans who bought money counters. Do you have a money counter at home or in the office? Only criminals and banks have money counters, right? Wait a minute. Criminals and bankers. Same difference, right? Well, as it turns out, the fact is banks and drug dealers make up a very small percentage of those who use money counting machines. All right, prove it, Johnny. Well, have you been in Costco or Sam's Club lately? You walk through the cash register and business aisle where they've got the file cabinets, cash registers, security cameras. You'll find a couple of different brands of money counters. And they're cheap, too. Some of them, under $100. Is that because Costco gives a discount to criminals, money launderers, and drug dealers? I don't think so. Well, it's because normal people use them all the time. And I'll bet every evangelical preacher has one, too. Because, you know, Jesus saves, right? Not to mention, there's hundreds of thousands of small businesses that use those things daily. But that doesn't seem to matter to the DEA or the IRS. Once again, if you own one of those things, you're considered guilty until proven innocent. Listen up. The article begins, under a sweeping surveillance program, the DEA, Drug Enforcement Agency, secretly spied on Americans who bought money counters, the vast majority of whom were never shown to be connected to illicit drug or money laundering activities at all. Turns out, in an extensive audit, the U.S. Department of Justice Office of Inspector General revealed that between 2008 and 2014, the DEA had collected tens of thousands of records, including the names, addresses, emails, phone numbers, etc., of those who bought money counters. Turns out the DEA is a bulk purchaser of retail data. So what's that mean? Well, places like Walmart, Shopko, Target, Sam's Club, sell their data and purchase records to government agencies like the DEA and Department of Justice. That, of course, includes Google, Amazon, eBay, all of them. Hey, they don't discriminate. If you got the dough, you can buy those lists, too. Oh, and it also says, the Inspector General found that the DEA and Treasury Department routinely issues administrative subpoenas to companies that sell and manufacture those money counters. Not only were those subpoenas conducted without any court oversight, they were unrelated to a specific drug trafficking investigation or target or crime. However, once the data was collected, the DEA and the Justice Department would send the raw data from thousands of purchases directly to its field offices, which would cross-reference data with several law enforcement agencies and databases. Then it says, even the Inspector General found it troubling that the DEA was able to do this without conducting a comprehensive legal analysis before starting the program and the bulk collecting of data. In fact, it says, when asked for a legal review about the process and subpoena program, one of the DEA's office managers, the Office of Chief Counsel, responded, well, we haven't had a federal court tell us we can't do it, so I guess we'll just continue on. Then it says, in a dark irony here, the DEA's dragnet collected so many records on money counter buyers The field offices began complaining that they had too much data, with one DEA staff coordinator writing, "There were just so many leads, we didn't even know which one to follow." Then it says, after indiscriminately collecting that data for almost 5 years, the DEA decided to disseminate it to other agencies, sending the bulk purchase money counter data to Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force, the ATF, the FBI, ICE, and 15 other federal agencies. So, if you're an innocent small businessman and you happen to be on that list, you are now a person of interest. You're not on just one feces list, you're on more than 15. Meanwhile, the Organized Crime Task Force Fusion Center is running all those names that have been collected without foundation through a massive government database system, producing comprehensive intelligence products, which include detailed information on money counter machine owners, their family members, and personal and business connections. Meanwhile, the DEA continues its version of stop and frisk, which let the agency confiscate over $3.2 billion from 65,000 cash money seizures. In other words, for example, if you happen to be driving along a highway and get pulled over for speeding, or you get a flat tire and a cop pulls you over and you've got $1,000 in cash sitting on your front seat, well, unless you have lots of receipts and backup proof right then and there, they can and will confiscate it. Of course, you've probably heard stories like that before. Hope it never happens to you, but it could. Which reminds me of a funny story that happened to one of my gringo expat friends in Guatemala. He owns a couple of businesses, and the customers often pay out in small bills. Every once in a while, he'll get enough $5 and $10 bills to fill a sack, and he'll run it over to the bank and deposit it. Now, normally, he says, he shoves it in the glove compartment or under the front seat of his car, but this particular day, he was in a hurry and had a plastic bag full of $5,000 in $5 and $10 bills sitting on his front seat. He couldn't see that it was money. It was closed, but nevertheless, there was a bag sitting on his front seat. So, as luck would have it, as he was driving, he got pulled over at one of those mandatory roadblock stops. We've discussed that before. There'll be 5 to maybe 10 or 12 cops off to the side of the road, lounging under a tree. And every once in a while, one will walk out, point his finger at you, and that means you got to pull over and they'll check your papers and stuff. Anyway, he got the finger that day, in more ways than one. Two cops walked up to him. He rolled down the window, handed them his paperwork, and one of them looked in and said, "What you got in that bag?" He said, "Money." They said, "Let's see." They saw it just jam-packed with dough. They said, "How much you got here?" And he told them, 5 or 10 grand, whatever it was. And they said, "Whose is it and where'd you get it?" And since my buddy was kind of irritable that day, he said in a short, direct way, in Spanish, of course, "I have a business. It's mine. So what?" And the two cops looked at each other, looked back at him, and one of them said, "All right, you can go." And that was that. Now, you might be thinking, well, you always hear stories of Latin cops being on the make, looking for bribes and stuff. Why didn't that happen to him? It would have been so easy, right? Well, you may have heard me mention this on a past show, but if you get pulled over by one or two cops, that's when they're most likely to hit you up for a bribe. But if there's three or four or a group of cops, like at one of those checkpoints, you'll almost never get hit up for a bribe. Why? Well, because cops in a big group most likely don't know everyone in the group, and they're not about to ask for bribes when there's one or two guys in the crowd that don't go in for that. And you know, I've experienced that myself. The only time I've ever been hit up for a bribe is when it's only one or two cops. Most notoriously, when there's two cops on a motorcycle. That means generally they're partners and they're working together and they have had a lot of time to work out a scam. Oh, and as for my buddy, well, he chalked the whole thing up to the gringo advantage. All right, speaking of reasons to get the hell out of Dodge, believe it or not, there are some DEA and IRS guys who are looking to get the hell out of Dodge too, after they retire, of course. That's why I want to read you this email that just came in. By the way, you heard me say I get tons of emails, and I do, but I think maybe my popularity's dropping off. You know, it's been more than a week now since I've gotten an email from a Nigerian prince in exile. Somehow I feel slighted. I'll have to up my game. Anyway, this email comes from Lucian. He says, "Dear Johnny, I too am a fallen Catholic, but don't tell my wife. I still play along and go to church with her on Sunday, and I'm never bored. That's because I've got an earbud in my left ear and she sits on my right. I listen to audiobooks and your podcast while she's listening to Fire and Brimstone. That said, Johnny, here's one I think you've never heard before. I'm an IRS agent. I've worked for 27 years in the agency. But I'm also a gonna-be expat too. 3 more years and it's south of the border for me. And that 3 years till pension time, I could do it in my sleep. Plus, it'll take all of that 3 years to convince the wife, though she's partly on board already. Yes, I do work for the IRS, but don't hold that against me. All right, me, Johnny here. Yes, Lucian, this is a first. I've never had the IRS write me an upbeat, personalized message before. Anyway, he says, Johnny, I realize everyone fears IRS agents, but did you know that the majority of agents that I know and work alongside are Catholics? I'm not sure if that's true throughout the nation, but it's certainly true in my office. Don't ask me how that happens. I don't know, but I know this. We actually have a Catholic patron saint, Saint Matthew. He's one of the original 12 apostles and the patron saint of bankers and tax collectors. He was a tax collector himself. All right, me, Johnny here. Lucian, didn't know that about St. Matthew. But I do know that back then, the Jews considered tax collectors to be traitors. And these days, most intelligent people will agree that bankers are thieves. Well, look, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Deutsche Bank, they get fined hundreds of millions a year for illegal practices like money laundering and overcharging and defrauding customers, but not a single person ever goes to jail. And I also know if a taxpayer lies or cheats to the tune of just a couple of grand, he's ruined forever. Lucian, the whole system stinks. You have to know that. Anyway, Lucian says, Johnny, I just thought you'd like to know this IRS guy listens to your show. And almost all of us hate our jobs, too. And it's also true, we do pick on certain people that rub us the wrong way. And we're nice to those who we think deserve it. We have our good and bad days like everyone else. Then he says, Johnny, keep up the good work. Hope to meet you someday. Signed, Lucian. Then he puts in parentheses, not my real name. Wonder why. All right, Lucian. Very interesting. I wonder if he's coming to the seminar. What do you say if he does show up? We slip him a ayahuasca Mickey and have him accidentally fall into a volcano. But it's true, there's no quicker way to rain on someone's party than to mention there's an IRS or FBI agent in the house. In fact, when I went to high school, there was a very cute girl in my French class whose dad was an FBI agent. Oh, she was hot all right, but she never had a boyfriend. In fact, I don't think she ever had a date. None of us guys had the huevos to ask her out. You kidding? Go to her house and have a stare down with her dad? Now I remember her name was Barbara Boyking. No, not Boinking. Boyking. You've been listening to the Expat Files Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, you can schedule a one-on-one phone call with me. But first, download my free Plan B questionnaire at www.thenewexpat.com. Better yet, if you want to get your Plan B going from right up there in the States, just sign up for my 9-hour Expat Essentials course. Get the perfect Plan B blueprint by going to theexpatfiles.com/academy. Nos vemos!